Cricket isn't a hat trick with your first three balls. It's getting the yips and being petrified you'll never finish your over.
Cricket isn't a game that rewards you for practice and hard work. It's losing the toss on day one, spending the day in the field, getting rained off the following week, failing on a wet wicket next match, getting dropped the week your dad comes to watch, and realising you've had one hit in a month.
Cricket isn't about taking pride in your wholehearted performance after a game. It's the moment of silent reflection when you're driving home in your 1993 Nissan Pulsar, having gleefully sledged their 16-year-old opening bat all day en route to his chanceless 136 knot, and you look at the Gatorade bottles strewn all over the passenger seat floor, the fuel icon that's been hovering on empty since last Thursday, and it suddenly hits you. You're 33, you're single, you still live with your parents, you own a 23-year-old car, and you're spending your weekend verbally abusing someone young enough to be your biological son.
The Grade Cricketer is a Twitter stream. It's about playing cricket at the grade level.
It's a tough, mean, dirty, dirty business being a great cricketer.
A lot of cricketers, you know, that's all they know. They've done it since they're 10 and they have a deep-seated fear of change.
But the Grade Cricket is all about being the most alpha version of yourself as possible at all costs and at all times.
I don't bat or bowl. I just feel the gully, count the number of dot balls in a row, sledge 15-year-olds, make me feel better about myself.
Thanks, champ.
Oh, no, you called me champ.
Hello and welcome to the Grade Cricketer podcast on Fox Sports. My name is Ian Higgins. I'm joined by Sam Perry and Dave Edwards from the Grade Cricketer. Brendan Julian's on the show this week. We're looking forward to speaking to BJ in a moment, our mate BJ. The second test, it's done and dusted. The series gone. The collapse. It's been. It's gone. It's happened. Change the record, boys. Hello. Welcome.
Thank you. Double welcome from Higgo. Always thanks, the best Higgo. Way to be welcomed.
Yeah.
Yeah. If ever there was a test match that reflected a really disappointing, dismaying, outright loss in grade cricket, then the second test was it.
Yeah.
Nothing but a complete calamity, a meek capitulation. Crisis in Australian cricket. Absolute crisis. But we revel in crisis, don't we, in grade cricketer, because then we can blame.
Well, the blame game people. Is the most important thing to come. And before we came on air today, I just noticed that Faf du Plessis was seen shining the ball with a lolly in his mouth. So obviously we can pin everything on that.
Cheated.
Just like Triscothic in 05 with the mints.
And every single other international cricketer ever since then.
It wasn't us, it was the ball. The ball did it. We're not bad at cricket.
So we lost in 2.5 days, gentlemen, which is obviously the equivalent of losing. I mean, it is the literal equivalent of losing outright in a day in grade cricket circles or in amateur sport. So that's demoralising. And I think for this instance, because we've lost heavily overseas, but that's overseas, out of sight, out of mind, didn't happen in our own soil. There were some people watching, even though it was in Hobart. So it's a thing.
Is that a question?
No, a statement.
just on the match, let's go through the second test quickly. A couple of the major moments from it. I wanted to just get your hot takes on it. I mean, earlier in the week, we learned that Matt Hayden kept the circle of trust. Did you guys read that?
Yeah.
So he's got a circle. We're in a circle, circular formation, so I thought we might sort of do a little bit of a circle of, I guess, reflection on the test. So a couple of points I wanted to raise and get your thoughts on. Warner's slash on day one, outside off stump, you know, the worst shot in test cricket, or is that just the way he plays?
I thought that might have been actually a decent tactic by South Africa to throw something out wide because on a seeming wicket, he might be likely to nick it. So I either think it was actually not that bad bowling because, of course, he's never going to leave that because we've seen Dave Warner do this 100 times now. First ball, wide outside of stump, he hits that for 4, 99 times out of 100. This time on a seeming wicket, nicks it, worst shot in the world.
That's just classic kind of cricket commentary, isn't it? You know, go out, play a natural game, be aggressive, but don't get out.
Yeah. Take risks, but also don't get out.
I mean, that's how Dave Warner made his name, isn't it? He burst onto the international scene in T20s, and now he's got every right to just chase those balls. Does everyone else in Australia have that opportunity or that kind of right to do so? I mean, I know that a lot of people have been talking about identity and what our cricketers mean and what they stand for. Dave Warner's obviously the guy that goes out and does that. But what's Joe Burns do? What's Usman Khawaja's role? What even is a Callum Ferguson?
I guess really what we're saying is that Warner's above the law. He has more rights than others.
I think we are saying that, yeah.
Okay, that's the finish on that. Callum Ferguson, you asked what a Callum Ferguson is. Well, we know more about his brother after this test match. So I don't know if you guys saw the footage. We've all seen it 1,000 times.
Yeah.
Ferguson got run out comically by the reserve wicketkeeper, of course. Yep. That's what happens in a collapse.
Yeah.
And cue the camera showing his brother looking great, actually, in what looked like some sort of really nice sort of fur or Jack London jacket.
Yep.
He's a UK-based lawyer.
Yeah.
Collar slightly popped as well.
Yeah.
It's some fashion talk on the side there. Absolutely blowing up and really good candid footage of him just standing up, throwing his hands up in the air.
Yeah.
Reminds me of the one time my dad came to watch me play And just got out early and then asked, where's dad? He'd already gone. He was, you know, 50 k's down the M5.
I had this vision of your dad there, like you get out and immediately you turn to your dad and you see him do exactly that, because as soon as you get out, the first thing you do is look at your dad.
Often my dad was already sitting in the car when I had the
engine on.
Engine on, reading the paper, he had grandstand on. I'm not sure if you guys picked this up, but Ricky Ponting was actually doing some commentary for, I think it was BT Sport. Our UK-based listeners will be able to tell me if I'm wrong there, but he was doing some commentary. Michael Vaughan was also on the air at the same time when Callum Ferguson got run out by the subfielder. Michael Vaughan, cue comedy, said, wouldn't you hate to be run out by a subfielder in a moment like this? Obviously, when Gary Pratt ran out Ponting in 2005 Ashes, right. And then he blew up. So that's quite good from Vaughan.
Long memories, those Englishmen.
Long memories, clinging on to 1966 and 2005.
Yeah. I think, you know, as with Trump's election, because obviously that was 20 minutes before we started talking about Trump, or even less, the worst thing is when you start hearing hot takes from people about why Trump won, and that didn't come before. The hot takes from the Englishmen now, the English people about why Australia's going bad, that's the worst thing about all of this. We have, I think, at this moment in time, have maybe had three or four different opinions from different countries who've also been in the sewer of cricket for a long time, telling us how we can get out. I think that's the biggest insult of all, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes, it is.
Yes,
exactly. I have nothing to add to that, but yes, it is.
The last moment I want to raise from the match, because now it's just more about recriminations, is Dean Elgar ducking when the ball was hit straight to him in the slips.
So that's how much they were pumping us, that he just didn't want that one.
No.
He didn't, and he didn't need it. So he just got out of the way. He thought, that might hurt my hands. I've got August hands. It was cold in Hobart.
Yeah. Everything in Hobart is a couple of months behind.
Or years.
Weather-wise. I don't want to be against Hobart.
Well, speaking of the weather, the whole of the second day was rained out. So, you know, obviously the Australian team would have been sitting in the change rooms, thinking about what they'd done, maybe playing a bit of French cricket.
Sure.
I'm not sure. Yeah. But it gave us at home the opportunity to watch some of the great games of old, and the Australia versus South Africa test of 94, that close thriller. Yeah. Not quite sure why Channel 9 wanted to show us a heartbreaker at our lowest ebb, but at least we did get to see some great players of old.
Yeah, that's true.
Was nice to feel something. I thought Damian Martin batted really well in the first innings. That often gets forgotten throughout that test match.
He really got thrown to the wolves after.
Yeah, he did. He was the massive scapegoat. He hit 50-odd.
Well, just, you know, a few minutes before he stepped on air, another scapegoat came to light in the form of Brod Marsh. Earlier in this day, we're recording on Wednesday night for our listeners who might catch this a few days later, but Cricket Australia came out in the morning and said, Brod Marsh isn't going anywhere. You know, he's staying true. And three hours later, not even, Brod Marsh, don't fancy it anymore. And tonight, Wednesday time, there's an extraordinary general meeting taking place at Cricket Australia headquarters, and they're going to choose a selector. Or a new head of selectors.
Mm.
What's that all about? What's that meeting gonna? What's gonna happen in that meeting?
I don't know what even gets said at that meeting. I mean, I saw someone on Twitter say that who were the selectors who were banging down the door with some great selections.
That's good, Tom Cowley. That was good from Tom.
Excellent stuff. Well played him. I don't know what's being said at this meeting, but it does seem extraordinary. And I don't even know. Like, is it the selectors' fault that we got bowled out twice?
Well, let's start talking about recriminations, right? Okay. I mean, because it's if there's anything that grade cricketers do well, it's cast blame and make excuses. We're watching that on a national scale now, which is wonderful. The first thing that we need to acknowledge is that everyone wants blood. There's got to be bloodletting everywhere, and it's got to be dramatic. And we've seen the first head roll, and there's lots of blood coming from it, but not enough for me. let's be honest. We want more blood. We want new players. We want other guys to go. Yeah. Everything must change.
Something else. Yeah.
I'm someone else.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's good that we're having this national conversation is really, really important. But at the same time, it's equally important for heads to roll on the ground and for blood to be let out, as you say. Rod Marsh is the first to go. Now we're going to have to pick a new team. Where do we even start?
Well, I think everybody needs to come into the side, every young player. So I think, Bancroft, Hanscom, Maddison, Hilton Cartwright, Kurt Patterson, Austin Waugh. He scored some runs in the 19s Carnival. Yeah, or 17s 19s. He looks good. So get Austin Waugh in. I think I just want a completely new side.
Yeah,
it's novelty.
Sons of old players. Let's just get sons of old players.
Yeah, sons of old players. Father son rule. We'll work something out. I mean, AFL. Speaking of father son rule, I mean, AFL's got a lot to blame. A lot of blame has to be cast at its door as well. And
I'm all for that casting blame. You know, it's as you said before, great cricketers' excuses for anything. I didn't pick it up. He started to bowl and I wasn't looking. I had low blood sugar. all valid excuses.
I mean, you talked about AFL just then. One thing that AFL clubs do really well is have culture, you know, a really strong culture.
I love culture.
And often they defer to things yoga. Like World War One yoga. Yeah. Often they look at, you know, World War One. War is a very common metaphor in sport.
Mm.
And I wonder if that's something Australia has forgotten recently. You know, maybe we should go back to these Howard era themes of mateship,
immigration,
you know, camaraderie,
policies.
Immigration policies. Oh, gun laws, all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, the more we can just completely recreate the 1990s, the better we'll be. I mean, that was Howard's dream, to drive Australia back to the 1950s, and I think it's kind of similar with our cricket side. I mean, the more we can make it the 90s, the better. I mean, flatter wickets, more power hitting, more sledging.
I mean, going back even further than that, I mean, Confucius once said that the man who moves a mountain begins by carrying away small stones. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's how we should be playing our cricket. I'm not saying we need to adopt ancient Chinese philosophy as a rule, but maybe just we just see out the balls, and when we don't get out in the rapid rate that we did. You know, we bat time.
Yeah.
Why aren't we batting time? I thought whenever I played great cricket, the common refrain was work hard. Mm. You've just got to work hard. Mm. As Australians, cricketers working hard.
Are they working hard?
A really good call. And maybe that's what they're just going to say. They're going to say that at the EGM tonight, the Extraordinary General Meeting. Maybe there'll just be a chant of just work hard.
Work hard and get these blokes out.
I think in the history of collapses that we've seen over the years, over the time of like recent years, you know, us being bowled out in South Africa for three, you know, in the Ashes, there's huge collapses as well. And now this... they're all still thinking we can get 400 today. Like even when we're 8 for 20, we think we can get to 400.
We're going 4 and over.
We're going 4 and over. Yeah. And there seems to be a real policy of I don't want you to leave it. But I think that might even stem, if I can lay blame, because you know, that's what we're here for.
Yes.
Maybe Darren Lehman should take some responsibility.
He's got to go.
Because he has to go. But because it's everything about his brand of cricket, which has, to be fair to him, has brought Australia back to number one in the world. We're obviously now 13th. But it was all about alpha, fastest bowlers, batsmen whacking it, you know, like big rigs in the team. And so, like, we won the Ashes.
Sledging.
Ashton Agar, pick him. He'll get 98 at number 11.
Yeah.
That was the kind of team he was trying to fashion.
See, I think the reason that Jackson Bird wasn't picked for this test match and Joe Minnie was because that ultimately Bird doesn't bowl quick enough. Bird has got a fantastic record. He's been down in Tasmania for a few years, even got his test cap by doing great things for Tasmania. Game at Hobart, seeming wicket, doesn't play, doesn't bowl quick enough, but also doesn't score enough runs, as Rod Marsh said in the selection panel.
There's something I have to confess, like there's a little bit of schadenfreude for me here, just to be... well, earnest is my word for a second. I feel like there's some comeuppance here for Australia's... ultra fundamentalist commitment to arrogant power attacking aggressive cricket.
Like alphadom.
Test cricket's more complex than that. And, you know, maybe maybe Test cricket's moved on. Maybe international cricket's moved on. Maybe Australia is like, you know, Windows 98. You know, good software at the time.
Good
top of the line. It's not Mac OS. You know, Sierra
12.1
OS X. Whatever.
Guys, just for a moment, let's put this in perspective.
Let's do it.
We haven't won a game of cricket since September 27. That was against Ireland in an ODI. I'm not even sure if it was an actual ODI. It might have just been a friendly game. We won it. But that was 50 days ago.
Yeah.
We haven't won a game of cricket in 50 days.
Yeah.
Niall O'Brien couldn't play that match either for
Ireland. So it wasn't even a full strength.
Niall couldn't get in.
Yeah.
So
he fell over in the change room.
So it wasn't a full strength Ireland team that we beat, is what we're trying to say here. So look, it's been a really bad year for Australian cricket because we've stopped winning cricket matches, and ultimately that's what they need to try and
need
do.
To have more runs and wickets.
They need to try and win more cricket matches. But we've now been whitewashed in T20s. In India, we've been whitewashed in a one-day series in South Africa. We've
got the phrase whitewash.
I know, it is controversial, especially with apartheid.
No, Trump, that's a white lash.
A white lash.
That's different, yeah.
Not 50
and then a whitewash also in Sri Lanka. So we seem to be losing more than we're winning at the moment by a lot.
Big day?
No, big night. I've got to clean up the last two wickets, sing the song, do the covers, sing the song, drink 42 beers in the sheds, have a shower, sing the song, publicly objectify my teammates' rigs, compare sizes, tell everyone how good I was when I was 17, go to a strip club, lie to my wife, then spend all of Sunday being an emotionally absent father and husband. Big nights start with grade cricket. Lying to yourself has never been harder.
Dave, Ian... this is an interview that we've been wanting to line up for a very long time. For reasons that many listeners may be able to identify with, and we'll get to the reasons in a second. But we are sitting here in this podcast room. It's a room that this particular gentleman isn't quite aware of, I guess. He's well known around these particular studios, but we had to show him to the podcast room, which is in a dank back corner with a lot of mildew around the room, etc. I am talking about, of course, Brendan Julian, 7 tests, 25 ODIs, 4,000 first-class runs, plus over 400 wickets, plus Shield titles, living the dream, as Joe Casamento wrote in a feature piece a couple of years ago. Every Aussie bloke is wants to live your life, Brendan.
Really?
And now, of course, you're on the you're on the Great Cricketer podcast. Welcome.
Gentlemen, it is a pleasure to be here. I must admit, I walked into this room and I thought, what a pleasant room. There's not a window, not a painting, nothing, and it smells. So, I'm living your dream, I would have thought. So, it is a pleasure to be here. And you're right, I've never seen this room. I often walk past and didn't think anything was in here. So, you guys are in here now. That sort of makes it a bit better, doesn't it?
So what happened was last week...
Couldn't get anyone else.
Last minute replacement. So thanks for popping in. But last week I actually walked past the green room and you had your shirt off. I was the guy taking the photos and I thought we need to get Brendan Julian on this podcast.
That would be awful.
Well, that's why we all have our shirts off today through this podcast in solidarity.
Yeah.
And I've got a suit on.
But obviously, Brendan, the first thing you said as you walked into the room was, what is this? This is the Great Cricketer podcast, riffing on amateurism. So we always start with one question, the first question. What is your relationship to grade cricket, if any?
Well, probably to put it into perspective, in my very last year of Sheffield Shield cricket, we had a new coach called Mike Valletta, great opening batsman from Australia, Western Australian legend, and he became...
Canberra Commons.
Yes, correct. And... also, he became the coach. Wayne Clark finished. He came in and he sat me down at the start of the season and he said, now, BJ, I've been going through your grade cricket stats and I've got to say they are very unimpressive. You hardly go to the games and when you go there, you don't really bowl many overs and then you bat and then you go home. Now, I'm the new coach, so I really want you to perform a lot better in grade cricket. And I want you to make more of an effort in grade cricket. And I went, mate, okay, I take that on board. We had a meeting for about an hour and a half. We went home. I rang him the next day and said, mate, I'm retiring. And he said, what are you talking about? I said, mate, I've had a gutful. I'm not playing anymore. So I quit grade cricket. I quit Sheffield Shield cricket. I quit all forms of cricket. I've never played a game since. So, and I've been asked many times to come and play grade cricket. And I said, you've got to be joking.
You see, BJ, if I may call you that, we've interviewed a couple of people leading up onto this show. We've had Merv Hughes, we've had Ed Cowan, we've had Brad Hogg, and each of them have been kind of...
That loves great cricket.
Well, that's right. Very effusive in their praise about great cricket and maybe trying to sell themselves as rootsy kind of people. You're just being a bit honest here, aren't you?
You're being rock and roll.
I loved great cricket because I played great cricket when I was at school. From year 10, 11, 12, I used to play school cricket Friday and Saturday and then play club cricket on Sunday because we played one-day cricket. My first ever grade game, 7,000 people rolled up to the ground. So I walked down and thought, they're obviously here to see me. And then there were protesters saying, go home, go home, go home. And I'm like, oh, that's not quite right. And then Kim Hughes walked out with Terry Alderman. They just got back from South Africa. So my first game of club cricket was against Subiaco Floret in Perth. I played against Kim Hughes, Terry Alderman and Dennis Hilly, my first ever club game. So I thought it was pretty good.
So that was just a ticker-tape parade, basically, for the returning Ashes team, and you just walked straight into it.
Unbelievable.
No, it was apartheid-era protest.
Yeah, and it was great. I loved it. I faced Lilly, and he got me out because I was watching his action. Well, I thought I loved his action, but I just, I don't know, caught behind or something like that. So that was my first club game. So I thought, how good is this?
Where was your grade cricket debut, Higos? What happened?
My grade cricket debut. Is there a story that I don't know about? I tell you what,
it was at Maryland.
It wasn't watching Dennis Lilly's action running. It was just some 43-year-old bank manager bowling at me, and I was just hypnotised by his gut and missed a full toss and bowled.
Fast?
Off spin.
Well, yeah. Merv still played club cricket, so, you know, that was similar.
Very similar, yeah.
But then on to your actual career itself. BJ, you made your test debut.
I didn't play many tests, did I? I mean, I went on more tours than played tests.
We want to get to that later. We want to get your thoughts on some of those epic tours. But we go back first to your test debut, which I think happened in 1993 in England.
Thinking correctly.
You try and you work hard to play for Australia, and then it just happens very suddenly. And I believe you got, you know, seconds before the toss, Alan Border's come to you and he said, you're up.
He did. He did. I was sitting in the change room at Old Trafford, first test match, day one, and I'm sitting next to Tim May. And we went into that side thinking, will we play two spinners or will we play an extra seamer? It was Merv, Craig McDermott, myself, that could be the three, and then Warnie obviously playing. And we thought, well, wicket was turning, Tim May bowled pretty well. And then it started to rain. And then that sort of threw everything out. So AB was talking to Simo, and they're chatting, and I'm sitting in the change room, and AB's just putting on his jacket, going to toss the coin. And I sat next to Maisie, and I said, oh, well, mate, you must be playing because no one's told me I'm playing. So, you know, I'll just, you know, all good, sandwiches, coffee, relaxing, put the TV on as you normally do. And then Maisie goes, no, I'm not playing. I think I'm 12th man. I went, well, I thought it was there between you and I. Obviously, it wasn't. I thought, oh, well, I'm not playing. AB came over and I sat down. I was already sitting down. Maisie sat next to me and AB walks in. He puts his jacket on and he goes, he looked at me, he looked at Maisie, and then he went, oh, BJ, you play. And then walked out.
The greatest moment in your life.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's basically just toss the coin.
I know, you know. And I look at the guys now and they get their baggy green. Everyone's around and they get their family to come over. And all that didn't even happen when I was around.
And you sit side by side Alan Border.
No, he can't remember.
He can't remember.
Nah.
He's old, isn't he?
No, he can't remember that.
But he's the absolute godfather of Australian cricket, you would have been quite intimidated him as a youngster.
He is. He was the Don Corleone. He was. Yep. And I had just met him only about a week before, because when I was on the way to England, I flew through Melbourne and I got in the hotel and got all my gear and whatever, and then it's like meet down at the bar. And so I went down the bar and he was, you know, standing at the bar having a drink with Dermot and Heels and all Junior and Tugger and all these nicknames. Mm. And I'm like, you know, Junior, who's Junior? I don't know who Junior is. And I'm like, Tugger, who's that?
Steve Ward.
I'd never met them. Exactly, I'd never met them. And
just
so I had to go and introduce myself. So, you know, Brendan Julian, AB went, g'day mate, how are you going? Where are you from? I said, WA. He said, oh, good. You and the team? I said, I'm in the squad. Apparently, you got a piece of paper. And he goes, oh, mate, great, fantastic, flying out tomorrow. It'll be fun. And that was it.
It never stops, does it? The alphaing in cricket. You're playing for Australia and you're still getting alpha.
I know. So
it's remarkable how many of these stories are coming through about new entrants into the Australian side being known or recognised.
Mate, I remember getting off the plane at Heathrow and the guy thought I was Bruce Reid. these were the press.
The ultimate insult.
These were the press guys.
Both left armers.
Yeah.
To be honest.
I thought I was a bit bigger, but no. So I'd explain myself. And that, you know, that was fine. 93, you know, living the dream, apparently.
Well, obviously, in that match, I say obviously, it's not obvious at all. There's a story that Michael Slater believed that he was number 356 to debut for Australia. You debuted in the same match.
I did.
And it was you who was assigned number 356. Meanwhile, Slats, if I may call him that, has got a Ferrari number plate with 356, has got a tattoo with 356, and he had to clear it with CA and yourself, I read, to switch that number over. Now, I just want to know, what's that conversation like? You get the phone call or whatever it is, and what does Michael say? And is this true at all?
No, I didn't hear it from him. He didn't call me. It happened after the tour. I had to sign an affidavit to release my number.
We were just joking about that. You must have had to sign an NDA of some description.
No. It was a legal document saying that you relinquish your test number and inherit another number. And
so you had to move your tattoo, obviously.
Yeah. Correct. Yeah. Yeah. Correct. Yeah. I moved my tattoo and changed the last number. Mm-hmm. And Slats, when we caught up, I don't know where we caught up, he just went, oh, mate. I just thought because I walked out in the ground first that, you know, because we won the toss and batted, I would be ahead of you. So therefore I took the ground and played before you. So I should be ahead of you.
I heard it was because he thought he was the opening batsman and therefore he's before you. That's just correct. Very presumptuous.
Well, because he took the field first.
Oh, right.
Well, we batted. So he thought, well, I'm out there before you are.
And he didn't think you were playing. Neither did you.
I don't know if he thought I was playing.
It's like getting on the handball court at recess first. Like, I'm in.
I'm king.
Yeah, I'm in. I'm king. I'm in. Yeah. I mean, I'll take the first one. But he forgot to think it was in alphabetical order.
So the first test match that you played in 93 in Manchester, it was iconic for a number of reasons. Not only for your 56 not out in the final innings of the match.
Not in that test match.
Not in that test match. No, good week.
That was my third
test
match.
We'll edit that out.
Good week. Right. Third test match. Anyway, I won't. You want me to correct you? Or?
Please do. No.
Yeah. Fantasy world here.
Please. It's good when there's mistakes in improv.
Please out for me.
Yep.
So the first test match.
I hit a six to bring up my 50. Did you know that?
Yeah, I did know that. Yeah. And what did Steve Waugh walk down the wicket and say to you?
Anyway, now let's. We'll
do you know your precise stats of all forms of the game?
I don't. Okay, what do I average? I reckon I average 50 with the ball.
What did I average
with the ball? 50 with the ball?
I don't know.
Anyway, sorry, mate. What are you talking about?
Manchester, 93.
Yes. I remember it well.
You're fielding it mid-off. Shane Warne gets thrown the ball.
Yes.
How do you remember it?
Well, I was actually mid-on. So I remember it pretty well.
Wikipedia, mate. Get off that. Get some real stuff.
Sorry, Shane Warne throws me the ball?
Shane Warne was thrown the ball to bowl his first ball in England.
This is going well.
Yep. He was.
He's bowling to Mike Adding.
I threw him the ball.
You threw him the ball?
Yep.
You said, Shane, pitch it up.
I didn't say that. I can't remember what I said. Warne just threw it to me and went, what do you reckon? I went, I'm playing my first test, so I don't really know. He said, good start. All right. That was it.
You've literally just added new content to one of the greatest moments in cricket. Yeah. Now we know what was said before.
There's been books written about that ball.
And
revisions needed.
It has. And it's just got bigger and bigger, hasn't it? What is it? Ball of the century now?
Ball of the century, apparently. Yeah, but that was last century, so that's old news.
Well, it's the ball of the test match, and then all of a sudden it's the ball of the century. But I don't reckon too many people. I didn't actually know it bowled him because they couldn't see.
Did you think Ian Healy had knocked the bails over?
Well, Heels didn't know either.
Okay.
He sort of went sort of bit leg side and didn't quite see it and then realised, and Gat obviously didn't realise that it had bowled him as well. So it was sort of a non-event, but, you know, let's not spoil the dream.
Julian says Gatting ball is non-event. Fox Sports clickbait tomorrow.
At the start, it was a non-event. And the most disappointing thing about that, and I don't know, you might have these questions, but I'll jump forward. I actually took my first test wicket just after that, and no one even congratulated me because I was still talking about that freaking ball.
Do you think your ball was a better ball than Shane Warne's ball of the century? Just looking for clickbait now.
Tell you what, it made a bigger dent in the stump. So what do you want me to say about that?
Said it all.
Philip DeFreitas, see you later. Middle stump out of the ground. So, I mean, I reckon if you looked at my delivery and his, I think mine's got a bit more on it. But the funny thing about it is that they kept showing it around the big screen. And like I said, I just got Philip DeFreitas and I thought I'd get the big high five. And boys just went, yeah, good on your BJ. What about that ball to Warne? So no one even knew it was my first test wicket.
Oh, really? I didn't know. Because when you see someone take their first test wicket now, they just get around them. It's the biggest celebration.
Why didn't anyone know it was
Because I was still talking about the ball of the century.
Okay, still
at least blokes didn't even know who he was when he debuted.
No.
Yeah.
So no one even knew I took a wicket. And I think I came off the ground, I got three for. And then someone went, hey, mate, geez, that's right. Hey, well done. I was in the change room at the end of the day's play having a beer with Booney or something. And
did you play?
Mate, Well done. Who was that first week? I went, oh, mate, don't worry about it. And he went, oh, okay. Yeah, what about that ball of Warne?
It's just an amazing time in cricket, BJ, because everybody's just talking about how bad it was to play for Australia. And it seems to still be bad. What's that about?
I don't know. Well, you know, it's only bad in your eyes, in my eyes. I mean, you know, it's just, you just got on with it, you know.
Just a day job?
Yeah, you just got flung a cap, I grabbed it and walked out, took a wicket, no one cared, didn't even get a stump. Nothing.
Boyhood dreams just being debunked on the Great Cricket Podcast
amazing,
on a weekly basis.
And now you're here talking to us.
Yeah.
I know. It doesn't get any worse, but then you look at it and you go, yep, it does.
Let's talk about the Caribbean in 95, though.
Let's do that.
Run us through that tour. How could that not be the greatest of all tours to have ever been on for multiple reasons, social, cricket, otherwise?
Mm. Wow. Jeez, how long have we got?
All night.
Let's shorten it up then. 95, very good. Very good tour. Going over to that, to the West Indies against Ambrose, Walsh, Lara, Richie Rich, had a cracking team. So for us, it was always a big, big thing. You know, we didn't always think that we were going to knock them over. I didn't even think I was playing, which I wasn't, because I only really play Test cricket when people get injured. And that particular stage, Flem got injured. So there's me. Yeah, let's give BJ another game. So that was right. So I flew, I don't know, 65 hours across the world, and landed in Guyana. Have you ever been to Guyana?
No.
No.
Mate, don't go. And I'm thinking, God, we're in the West Indies and this is it. This is an absolute dump. It's a dump. And anyway, yeah, I thought the West Indies, geez, a bit third world. Far out. It wasn't exactly all those beautiful brochures on the plane, right, which I'd read in my 65-hour trip all the way from Perth all the way to Guyana, South America.
Well, that's eminently disappointing.
Yeah, but it went to Barbados, played first test, so that was good. That Barbados is a good spot. Mm. You been there?
No.
Oh, it's amazing. You stand at the ground and then you look up in the air and then all you just see all these, you know, British Airways flights coming in, Virgin Atlantic flights coming in, and you're thinking, no, how good's this going to be tonight? So Barbados.
How good was it?
How good was it?
Well, we were trying to play cricket, and I was trying to play cricket. So winning a test match, I think, was very, very good. We won in 3 days, I think, first test.
The actual series itself, and I don't know from your perspective, but from my perspective, I was 9 years old, and it was just the most like wonderful. There were these great names on both sides, and for Australia to beat the West Indies first time they'd lost a series in
27
years.
Yeah.
So it just seemed like a really huge moment. Did it feel like a huge moment when you won the fourth test as well?
And that was big. It was a big event because it got built up. And by the time we got to the fourth test match, the series was level. Mm-hmm. And Richard come out saying, you know, worst team I've ever seen, the bowling I've never even heard of, and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And we'd won so convincingly in Barbados, drew in Antigua, lost in Trinidad, and then Jamaica. And Jamaica's a big atmosphere, it's a big ground. Have you guys been in Jamaica?
No.
We've been nowhere.
Yeah,
nowhere.
Don't go there. No. That's crap.
Well, you would know from Getaway.
I didn't even go to Jamaica and Getaway.
No.
But you wouldn't go there because you drive on the way to the ground, it's the jail, and half the side of the ground is a jail, so you'll get the inmates coming in and they fence it off. It's like a jungle.
Jesus.
Yeah, no, it's rough. Rough as. Jamaica would be one of the roughest places to go to. You can't walk outside your hotel.
Really?
You get mugged. Yeah. I'm talking enough, aren't I? So at the ground in Jamaica, one whole side is all the inmates.
Right.
And they're just pelting stuff at you. There's big chicken wire up to protect you from stuff getting thrown at you and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. And I'm always down on the boundary because, you know, that's what the bowlers did.
Yeah.
So it was a big test match. And when we sort of got our noses in front where Tugger got 100, no, 200?
200.
200, what did Junior get?
126.
126, there you go. So when they batted well, we thought we were going to win this. We were sort of well on top. Ambrose had bowled well. Walsh had bowled well. And those guys batted, you know, so unbelievably well. And that was the big one where Craig Ritchie came out on the ground.
I was going to say.
That was a big moment. Big moment.
That was a bigger moment for the dressing room than Tugger's 200.
Well, I think so, because not only did Fat Cat come out and congratulate both of them or Tugger, I can't remember. Anyway.
I think it was just Steve Waugh.
Was it? Yeah, Steve. So
I can't call him Tugger.
No, I
can't. Steve Waugh from me.
No, yeah, me too.
Until invited.
And then he went out, obviously, you know, congratulated Tugger and blah, 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 ran straight to the change room, went straight to the fridge, took about 8 Coronas, and then went back. Up into the grandstand.
What a cameo.
Yeah.
Well, while we're speaking about crowd engagement in the West Indies, I'm just going to read a quick little match report. This is via ESPN Cricket Info from a one-day international in 1999, so 4 years later, obviously.
1999. Yeah, got it.
And you and Sherwin Campbell had an incident mid-pitch.
Unfortunate.
So, absolutely. I've seen the footage, and I agree with you. I'll read the article.
Yep. Footage is available on
YouTube. Set it up.
Angered cricket fans threw Kensington Oval into disarray yesterday by hurling hundreds of bottles onto the field and halting play for 45 minutes. This followed a mid-pitch collision between Barbadian batting hero Sherwin Campbell and Australian bowler Brendan Julian in the final game of a tense and enthralling one-day series. Campbell fell and never made it to his end of the wicket. While still on the ground, he appealed to umpire Eddie Nichols, who gave him run out. As Campbell made his way to the pavilion, rebellion erupted. Bottles began to fly onto the ground, firstly one by one, then by the tens. Then there were two concrete blocks, chicken bones, two plastic chairs, almost anything patrons laid their hands on. The entire perimeter of Kensington was littered with missiles. The players made their way to the dressing room and more missiles trailed them. Australian captain Steve Waugh narrowly missed being struck by a bottle as he was about to enter the pavilion, escorted by the police. This was also about 5 days after a massive pitch invasion, also in a one-dayer where a match was tied. Steve Waugh and I think Shane Warne were batting at the time. They were going for the third run to tie the match, and basically the whole crowd ran on the field, and it looked really scary. Do you remember the incident?
Yep.
Really well. Was it terrifying?
The one in Guyana?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't out there. I didn't really care.
No.
It wouldn't bother me. You know, Warnie does get a bit hysterical. So,
good tactic.
Yeah, he was trying to get back for the third, and he wasn't the fastest between the wickets.
No.
Warnie?
But the one
I was involved. Well, yeah, I remember that. I bowled the ball, ran across to the left-hand side. Yep. I sort of stopped, my arms out, and...
Which is the normal way you finish a delivery.
I do. If you want to stop the other guy getting past you, yeah, it is. And the other guy was Michael Bevan.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because he was coming in to field the ball.
Yeah. Yeah, he was quick.
Sherman Campbell, you know, he hit my elbow and he fell down and he carried on. I'm like, mate, he's out.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then, you know, I didn't think too much of it. You know?
No.
There was no big screen there, so I couldn't see how bad it was. So I thought, oh, that's just the way it rolls.
But sort of coming off the ground and there were missiles being flung. I mean, there's concrete blocks and there's chicken bones.
Yeah,
obviously the most fierce.
We made a hasty exit to the change room.
Yeah.
No doubt about that. And, you know, Stephen Waugh wasn't happy and players weren't happy. And we always sat the change room and I went, right, let's go home. no real reason to hang around. And we were all ready to roll and we were packing our bags. And then Sir Garfield Sobers came in.
Mm-hmm.
Said, I don't think you're going to get out of the ground unless you go out and play. And we all looked at him and went, mate, this guy's lost it.
So many aspects of the game.
I know he's a legend, but this guy seriously lost it. And Tugger goes, what do you mean? And he goes, well, mate, they're going to tear the joint down. Bus driver's not even going to drive. He's not driving. You know,
He holds all the cards.
I didn't know how to drive a bus. Didn't even have the keys. And then Tugger goes, all right, well, we better go back out then. And then, you know, that went on for about half an hour, the toing and froing and all that sort of stuff. And then we made our way back out.
Didn't you guys agree to reinstate Sherwin Campbell?
Well, we had to, didn't we?
Yeah, I guess so.
I mean, that was more just to get us home safely.
Yeah, fair enough.
And then we thought, oh, well, we'll probably win the game. And
he's an easy wicket anyway.
Yeah, I thought that. We lost the game, I think. I think we lost it on purpose.
Yeah,
I think we
safer.
Yeah, but then Tugger goes to
more clickbait for Fox.
Tugger goes, mate, you're down on the boundary. And I went, mate, I'm not going on the boundary. They're going to kill me. He went, all right, come on, down third man. I went, not going.
Yeah, four slips in.
I'm staying in the ring.
Yeah.
And I fielded in the ring. Yeah. And I don't know. Junior might have gone down there. I'm not too sure.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we gutted it out, finished the game and went home.
Yeah.
Back to the safer confines of Australian domestic cricket. You are considered a bit of a legend at the Shield level. Mm.
Really?
I'm just saying that it's just pleasantries for mine.
I wouldn't have thought so.
But honestly, though, you've got it. How many titles did you win? I think you're a man of the match in a Sheffield Shield winning final.
Was I?
Was I? It means nothing to me. It means everything to me.
At the gap?
The one where you hit 100 and took a bunch of wickets and you won. Yeah.
I don't think I was a man of the match in that one. Oh, yeah, no, I did too. Tassie.
Yep.
I think I won two titles.
Yeah, back to back.
Right, back to back.
Yeah. 97, 98, 98, 99.
Yeah, okay.
Obviously fond memories.
Yeah. Actually, I might have won three titles.
This is the host of Inside
Cricket. What was your question?
I just wanted to bring
what's it like to win and be good?
Mate, there's no water cue, I'm no good.
We just want to gently run you through your career from start to finish before we start the throwdown session. What's it like to hold up the Sheffield Shield?
It's bloody heavy. Have you held it up?
No. I've gone to Jamaica really or held the Sheffield Shield.
No.
It's really, really heavy. It's like a big velvet, old, crusty thing. But a great-looking trophy, I must admit.
Yeah.
When you look at Sheffield Shield, when you play it and you look at it now, and there's obviously a lot of discussion about the next crop of Australian cricketers and where they're going to come from, have you seen dramatic changes in how Sheffield Shield is held by the administrators or, you know, the level of it? Or please just say whatever you want.
I think so. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that the Sheffield Shield cricket is probably not as competitive as what it was. And I think that's the players' point of view, because I think the players are better now. Players are better, they're stronger, they're fitter, they're faster, they're more informed, they're more prepared. They've got a lot more going on. They're a lot better. Players are a lot better now than what they were 20 years ago. I have no doubt about that. But I don't think they're put in tough conditions. And I think Sheffield is going down that track where it's more of a support mechanism for the national side. So therefore, you don't get strong and competitive games of cricket. You know, you can't have a game of cricket where one bowler is told you can only bowl half the game, and then we'll swap it over and put another bowler in, and then we'll change it around. And, you know, so if you're going to go down that track, then I think you're setting up failure. And I've been saying this for a while. It's not because the Australian cricket team is playing badly at the moment, but you're not getting hardened, seasoned cricketers coming through. And that's why probably in the last 10 to 15 years, you're not seeing the Haydens, the Damien Martins, you know, the Stewie Laws, Brad Hodges, and, you know, go back to Jamie Sidney. You're not seeing guys score 1,000 runs in Sheffield Shield cricket. Yes, you're going to get the exceptions that will always play well. Adam Voges found it hard to get in the side, and then he basically made the Australian side because they went back to the youth, didn't happen, and then they went, oh, well, let's pick some of these old guys. Mm. Chris Rogers got picked, same thing. And they're capable test cricketers, no doubt about it, but you're not going to get the guys at the moment that are just really knocking the door. And if you're playing now, you know, first-class cricket, it's the best time to play for Australia. I mean, because there's no one out there. There's no one knocking down the door. I mean, got a test match coming up in Adelaide, and anyone could get it. Someone gets 115 Shield games starting before the test match, I reckon they're a good chance of playing. And that's unheard of. You wouldn't have copped that 20 years ago. You had to make 10,000 to get in the side. So it's a good time to play for Australia. Whether you're good enough to stay there, well, that's a different question.
I think it's a really good moment. I mean, everyone is assessing the state of everything in Australian cricket at the moment. I've got one a little bit from left field, though, BJ. So, I mean, how would you assess the state of Australian cricket commentary at the moment, as in the voices that are in the game, not asking for like a...
See, that's delving into my area.
Of course, and so obviously you're employed in this room that we're in at the moment, yeah, et cetera. But, I mean, is this a golden era for Australian cricket commentary, for example?
Well, I think... At the moment, we're just sort of seeing probably networks trying different things all the time. And I think that's probably because the audience appetite expects people to be a bit different, a bit quirky. I think it's hard being a cricket commentator now because you're always compared to guys of the past. You know, obviously Channel 9, Greggy and Bill Laurie and Richie and all that. But if you hear them 20 years ago on the reruns, they were shocking. I mean, they're terrible. Come on, you can't tell me that
you're right.
They were more informed. But, you know, if you've got a great voice and you've been in there a long time, you know, they love it. I mean, people love Richie. You know, I mean, the last 10 years, really, he could say anything and people love it. And that's great and that's fine. I've got no problems with that. But I think being a cricket commentator now is hard because you're always thinking, how am I going to be different? How am I going to do this? Am I going to say this? And they just over-talk it, over-commentate it. I mean, listen to the first test match on the Nine guys. And they're just going a million miles an hour. And I think they feel under pressure to just add so much and add so much where it becomes a bit of noise. Mm. So I tend to think it's a little bit overcomplicated when it doesn't need to be. But
would you say that as well, that people expect commentators to be successful straight away? Because broadcasting is a skill.
Yeah, I think
so. And
much
the same way the players want their debutants to score hundreds on debut, they want their Michael Clarks, Kevin Petersons to be outstanding broadcasters straight away, when actually it's quite a difficult skill to master.
Yeah.
It takes years.
Look, it is. And I think you're right. I think social media is a big thing because all of a sudden you're just getting hammered. I'm not even on Twitter, so because I just get too many trolls. I mean, man.
Neither.
You wouldn't get too many trolls. And what do you do with them all? But it's hard because every word that you say is picked up, everything that you do is picked up, and, you know, and it just gets, you know, regurgitated all the time. Now, you know, when the guys started commentating 20, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, whatever it was, no one knew. There was nothing to compare it to. So it's like, oh, well, these guys are right, and I'll slap it on and I'll listen to it, and it's good. But I think now it's hard, really, really difficult. And broadcasting is not easy. I mean, there's no manual for it. I first worked Channel 9, and, mate, no one told you how to commentate. You just sink or swim, and the only time you get feedback is when you're getting flicked. Mate, you're crap. See you later. Good work.
Yeah. Everything's so cutthroat.
No, it's so cutthroat. Australian society in general.
It's impact now. Everything wants something different. They want this, they want that. And I mean, Nine's been amazing because they've kept with the same guys all the time.
Yeah.
And I think they've done that because people just love to hear the same voice and they get used to it, so that's all right. But
it's all we've ever known, and we have a deep-seated fear of change.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And you're coming through now, and it's like, mate, this guy's rubbish, and he's really good. Bring back the old guys. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's what people are used to, I suppose.
Yeah.
Very insightful, very insightful.
I think maybe, guys, we should shift this section of the interview to the throwdown section, where we basically just pepper you with some short stuff, really quick, fast throwdowns. Mm. One sentence answers maximum from you.
How many words in that sentence?
25 or less, generally.
But if you want to use semicolons and stuff, you can conjoin the sentences. And,
abbreviation. Exclamation point.
You can use as many acronyms, abbreviations, semicolons as you wish.
Yep.
The floor is yours.
Go.
I'll start.
Please.
Mm. So you're a Kiwi by birth. BJ, I believe.
He asked me, or was that a statement?
I'm just leading to
a
question.
Sorry.
Jeez, I'm getting outfitted every turn.
Okay.
Do you ever regret leaving New Zealand and therefore giving up the opportunity to play 160 plus tests?
No. Do I have to make long
answers? No.
Sorry, no.
BJ, 2 weeks ago, Ed Cowan sat in your chair. He was on the show and he said quite honestly that Sheffield Shield cricket was as much an exercise in rig admiration. So that's
whatever that means.
Rig admiration, just of the body,
the male
torso between players. As anything else, was that true of your time playing cricket? Was there a lot of rig admiration? If so, what's your relationship to your own rig and the rigs of others?
Okay, no, I don't think the admiration was there. Definitely, there was no sort of look at me, get your shirt off scenario because you know tattoos weren't weren't in vogue then. So no. Mm. And what was the other question?
Did you care much for the rigs of others then?
In the team?
Hey, all around Sheffield Shield, just the whole scene.
But you're in the cricket scene.
Not really. I mean, my first roommate in Test cricket was Merv Hughes, so that sort of put me off a fair bit.
Great
big,
rig.
Fat, hairy
but
thing.
But you must have noticed the proliferation, should I say, of the word rig, just generally in cricket circles. You're involved in cricket. Mark Waugh, AB, aren't they talking about their rigs?
No. It's funny, that.
We found the echelon of Australian cricket that doesn't speak about rigs or circuits.
No. I could ask AB or Junior that. And they
rigs,
know
pipes, it. Levers, any industrial terms used to describe the male body?
Chopping.
No. I haven't, no.
Wonderful. Yeah. That's good. Here goes.
Do you think Greg Blewett secretly hates you because he would be the best-looking member of the Fox Sports panel if you weren't hosting?
Definitely.
Yeah. You first entered the world of TV presenting, I believe, on Getaway.
Well, before that, but yeah, go.
Lifestyle TV.
Yeah. Before that, but yeah, go.
Alfred.
Doesn't know his own cricket career, but does know the broadcasting career very well.
I just want to know, to what degree were you inspired by Mike Whitney on Who Dares Wins?
I didn't even know he did that.
You didn't know?
No, didn't even know he did really? That when I did get
it. It was a game changer in lifestyle TV.
Like iconic, yeah. Really iconic. Yeah.
Right. First left armer. First arm, left arm quick to really make him in television.
That's
I would have
category.
Thought you would have known about that.
No.
Just back to the cricket, BJ. Australian batting coach Graham Hick seems to have been accepted very well, hasn't he?
Wasn't that a good appointment? I bet you he was happy. I watched him on the TV down there. I thought, geez, I bet you he is loving his job at the moment.
I don't think he's on social media.
No. Good man, Hickey. Very good man.
Of course.
But, gee, why would you want to go down there for that, eh?
In the first test of that West Indies tour of 1995, you had Brian Lara caught a gully. He was on 65 as well, so seeing him big. Steve Waugh caught him in the gully.
Yeah.
How little do you care that he actually dropped it?
Didn't bother me. No. Mate, did not bother me at all. Didn't bother Tugger. He didn't care.
Claim it.
Mate, we said it. Mate, don't worry about that. Let's move on.
Yeah.
Mate, they wouldn't have picked that up on the TV.
No.
Yeah. And then we sort of at the end of the day went, they did pick it up.
He dropped it. He dropped it. He said he was out.
But I said, mate, he's out. Yeah, and then the paper tomorrow, it will say out.
Yeah, pack him.
So I'll take him.
Yeah.
Later.
So BJ, all week we've heard that it's with cricket, it's too stale, it needs a shake-up, it's everyone else's fault, needs new blood. So with that in mind, just how ready are you for a job at Channel 9 again, and when do you expect to be offered a job?
Don't expect to be offered a job. They've tried to revamp it. They're doing a pretty good job, you know. You've got KP. Gee, you've got worse voice, haven't they? Has he got the worst voice ever?
Yes, it's a bad voice.
Bad voice.
Good player, bad voice.
Seriously, who's that guy on the TV?
How important is it to have a good voice in broadcasting?
Yeah.
You've got a great voice.
Oh, thanks, thanks. That's why I'm...
Is it the same as having big hands in sport?
Like the Trump.
The Trump.
The Trump,
yeah. Look, I think broadcasting, you've got to have a good voice. Yeah. I mean, Clarkie's voice is nearly as bad as Kevin Peterson's. I mean, it's that squeaky, high-pitched...
It's
not
pleasing, is it?
That.
No. And cricket goes for so long, you need someone with a beautiful
for ages.
Voice.
Mate.
Do you work on your voice?
You know what, it sounds better if I have a massive night out.
Yeah.
Yep.
So I've tried to incorporate that.
It's rock and roll.
That gravelly sort of...
Tom Waits.
Yeah, wherever he is. Yeah. Yeah, I liked it. I haven't taken up cigars yet, but I think you've got to have a pretty good voice. Doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get a gig, you know, Clarkie, Peterson.
BJ, you're a dedicated family man with a wife and two beautiful children. Are you ever allowed to talk about the 1995 West Indies tour?
You know what? The 95 West Indies tour wasn't, you know, I think there were other tours that were better than that one.
Really?
Yeah.
Which is a tour that we don't talk about much, which was just the greatest?
Yeah.
You said you went on a lot of tours and
stuff. Yeah, 93, 97, 99.
Yep.
South Africa, not bad. Pakistan.
Really?
Yeah. Circuit.
Is that the best circuit?
Pakistan's the best circuit.
Peshawar?
Geez, that US Embassy got a workout. I think we went there every night. Could have been a citizen there.
Circuit with the Pakistani players as well around that time.
Akram.
Good era for it.
Yeah, we didn't really. Yeah, it's amazing how you didn't really go into their change room because they weren't in there, really. They had to finish and go home anyway.
Didn't shower after the game. Didn't hang around.
Boy, didn't have any showers. Yeah. They don't have showers. Right. Just a tin shed, hole in the wall, and in the ground. So it was always pretty rough.
BJ, it's been an absolute pleasure, guys. What do you reckon? It's been wonderful. You've been very generous with your time. You've gone over your career. You've given us some insights on Australian cricket and the health of it at the moment. And you've stayed with us some throwdowns as well. Really appreciate it, mate.
Thanks. Now, is anyone going to listen to this or what?
No, we didn't. It's not recording.
Not recording. Not recording.
We're just mates.
Yeah, we're just
mates chatting with headphones.
Stuff, boy. I like it. Cheers. Get me back, eh? In about another 10 years?
10 years.
All right, let's lock that in.
Harry Broad, good morning. You've been reading The Great Cricketer.
But most of the book has taken up with proving he isn't good enough. Locker room language is rife and sexual immaturity is rampant. Having sexual relations is called burgling a chop. I'm very disappointed. I thought this should be a great book.
Okay, wasn't BJ wonderful? A couple of interesting and unexpected takes and non-takes on various elements of the game.
If there was dead air at any point, it was probably because we were just staring at him for a long time, so the editing process may be a little bit patchy there, but we did get lost in his eyes several times.
He did kind of live up to expectations. I mean, we were just remarking on his body language earlier. BJ, if you are listening to this, I doubt you are, but there was a lot of just leaning back in the chair and the hand over the head and two hands behind the head leaning. He looked every inch the getaway presenter with a Bondi, Bronte house.
Yeah, every
wonderful
single inch.
Tan as well. That didn't go unnoticed. Look, at this time, guys, this is where we answer your questions, and by your, I mean the followers, the disciples of The Great Cricketer.
Mm.
You guys aren't disciples, you're just guys with internet connections.
But you are all guys.
But you do you do ask us some questions and we do attempt to answer them every week. So I'll start with the first one, then Peter, maybe you can take over. This one's from Brett Baldwin. He says, is there a worse feeling, I assume he means in cricket, than calling for gloves and then being dismissed later in the same over?
Oh, well, I wasn't going to take the cricket angle, but I thought in life, there's a couple of worse feelings.
Yeah.
No.
I suppose, it's really the highs and lows of the game, isn't it? Because there's nothing, that's pretty much utopia for many batsmen to bat long enough to be able to call for gloves. Now, in most instances, you're looking at sort of 10 to 12 minutes of the crease because you need to take any advantage that you can to appear that you're working hard.
Yes.
So you get to that point where you're giving the hand signal. I'm making the hand signal now. Yes. This is great radio.
Yeah. You look like a puppet master.
And then you're dismissed. So it's really the highs and lows of cricket. So is there a worse feeling?
It can't be that bad because you own a second pair of gloves.
Well, that's
true. I think there could be nothing worse than if you were calling for a second set of gloves without actually owning them and just hoping someone
and then the
would
guy who brings it out. Goes, I've got some, they're mine. Yeah. But here you go.
That's the best way to get free kit, though.
Yeah. Okay, Rooster 746. I think he or she, let's just say he, wrote in last week, Rooster 746. I'm 33, married, no social life. Any tips for integrating with the 18 to 19-year-olds for my one night on the circuit?
Well, I'd be interested to know if how long Rooster's been married. If it's been 5+ years, you know, then you've missed a lot. The circuit has changed a lot in recent times.
It's changed a lot.
And he might be desperately found wanting. I'm not sure. You've probably been on quite a recent cricket circuit. He goes, you're probably best qualified to answer this for Rooster.
Well, it is. And Merv Hughes even touched on this a while ago in the first episode of the Great Cricketer podcast. And he said that the culture has changed a lot. And you know what? He's certainly right. So there's certainly less people drinking in the dressing rooms till 1 a.m. So that's going to change. Not many people.
Still people. Just less people.
Look, big changes. I mean, amphetamine addiction is a real thing.
Yeah.
Kids like ice these days, I think. Yeah. No, I'm 31, married and have no social life, so I've got nothing to offer there.
Yeah.
So moving on to the next one, Matt Bajan, at Matty Bag, says, what is the appropriate transport to a game? R. Carter's often spotted riding his push bike to state games at the SCG.
Well, first off, we need to pick him up here on by dropping Ryan Carter's name in a tweet. And that this tweet actually copped a few likes. So first off, well played on dropping state players' names into your tweets.
You think he's a mate of his?
I think he's pretending to be.
R. Carter. Yeah. I only speak about names as though they were presented in the paper in the early 90s.
Yeah. Look, I think the Carters, or R. Carters, obviously lives really close to the SCG. And I think the person who lives really close, he's 30 miles away, wears Lycra. But like the guy who lives closest to the ground is always trying to emphasise that. Like if you
100%.
If you're across the road from the ground, you're walking over barefoot, you're eating a piece of toast.
Of course.
And you're just trying to tell everyone, I'm the alpha dog. I live so close to the ground that I can just walk here bare feet. And that's probably what Carter's is trying to do, I imagine. It's also quite
cycling is equivalent. Yeah, that's right. And he doesn't have a wonderful reputation for that. Batting for change. Get onto it. That's a serious pursuit of his.
I shouldn't laugh at that.
Yeah. Okay. Next question. Wade Webster. Wade Webster says, who's in your top bloke international 11? And then Wadey Webster suggests his own.
Can we read his out? Because they're all wrong.
Yeah, okay. AB, Nossi, Moeen Ali, Misbah, Pudge, Shammy, Gale, Root, Wahab, Wokes.
I'd love to know how he came to those conclusions.
There's some of the worst names I've ever seen. Like, there's some wonderful cricketers in there, don't get me wrong. Moeen Ali might be a good shout.
I've been told he's a good bloke.
I'm not having Shammy. I'm not having Gale.
And we just spoke with Brendan Julian. I don't think AB, unless he's talking about AB de Villiers,
he probably is.
I assumed he was talking about Alan Border. Yeah. Who is just obviously.
There's only one AB.
Yeah. I see that, I instantly think Border.
I'd love if Alan Border just sat there incongruously with the rest of these modern day players.
So I think, and obviously WG Grace. He didn't say that,
Grace.
But he meant it. Grace, to his mates. So I'm thinking though, like your best bloke 11 aren't like steadfast first name on team sheets because those guys, to make it to that level,
aren't they?
They're just Autobots. They have to hit cricket balls since they were seven. They're not well-rounded people. You need fringe players who are just naturally gifted. I'm thinking your George Baileys of the world. Yeah. George Bailey's strong.
No, there's no Australians in this side.
No Australians in this
there
side.
There isn't.
No, well, I don't care about Whitey Webb.
Star. How are the New Zealanders not in there? Because I remember Brendan McCullum branded the New Zealanders. They were the nice guys of international cricket.
Good luck 11.
So there's many guys in that team that I think. I was going to say George Bailey for mine because George Bailey strikes me as a guy who would not only help you move house, but would also bring some extra boxes that he had lying around his place. He strikes me as that guy.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah.
Chris Gayle's obviously a great bloke too.
Yeah, really good bloke. Yeah,
clearly.
Real guy who gets it. Yeah. Yeah.
And I've got another one here, guys. This is Chris Ninkoff. He says...
Hi, Chris.
In the next podcast, can you discuss the humiliation of outright losses? Losing 20 wickets in 2 days cannot be recovered from. I like how definitive
he that's right. He is here. Again, we're removing that from a cricket context to a live context. It cannot be recovered from.
So he's basically answered the question there. Like, it cannot be. There's no recovery from this point forward.
That's his exact question. Can you discuss the humiliation?
Hope that helped, Chris.
Yeah.
Well, that's all the time we've got for this episode of the Grey Cricketer Podcast on Fox Sports. Brendan Julian was a wonderful guest. We've answered your questions. You can get us on Twitter, hashtag AskTGC.
And a couple of things. A big shout-out again to Shano on the music, Julia for the graphic design, Adrian Leung from Five Stripe Studios for doing our opening sequence. We're going to change a little bit next week with that AskTGC questions. We're going to theme it up. We're gonna ask you to ask us questions on particular themes. Any off the top of your head, boys?
Well, today we talked about the theme of blame quite extensively, so that would have been a good one for this week. So next week, obviously, the news cycle will shift. There'll be something else we can get our teeth into. There's plenty of things we can discuss. What do you reckon?
Yeah, that sounds good. See you next week.
Bye.
Cheers.